vote for him in the name of, they cannot choose party unity over patriotism or what's good for the country.
Donald Trump calling John Lewis all talk, 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 no action.
Well, we should get beyond the name calling. Obviously, James, John Lewis is about action and change. We are a better nation because of the sacrifice of John Lewis and Jose Williams and James Orange and Dr. King. We are a bigger, better nation because of their involvement, and that all is right now on the chopping block. And so it's a dark period, but we must not surrender our spirits.
Your response to the choice of Neil Gorsuch to be the next Supreme Court justice?
It's not enough to call them conservative. It's constriction. It's constriction of women's rights. Women are not going to allow any longer their bodies to be controlled by someone else. Women have the right to own their own bodies. That's a dimension. But it's not just women's rights. It's women's rights. It's workers' rights. It's just the rights of consumers. He is to the right of Scalia, and that itself should say an awful lot about the attempt to color the court.
And finally, the Muslim ban. People protesting all over the country right through today.
And the world. With the stroke of the pen, we ushered ourselves into isolation. When you push off on the Mexicans and Latin America, two-thirds of our hemisphere, you push off on China with the China policy issue, which is one-fourth of the Asian race in the world today. You push off on Europe and make them unsettled about NATO vis-a-vis Putin. And you push off on refugees. With one stroke of the pen, you put America in a moral and political isolationist position. We're made less secure by that ban. Less secure, not more secure.
Well, Reverend Jackson, I want to thank you for being with us.
And it is a ban.
So you agree with Donald Trump and Sean Spicer on that one.
That's what they said.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, longtime civil rights leader and presidential candidate. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional. This year, Contessa de la Luna brings you a real bona fide Wild West jamboree and variety show. We've got live performances by Contessa de la Luna and Courtney Vondrell from Three Leg Torso, plus audience lasso contests, sock puppet theater, surprise fun box drawing, many other prizes. We've got performances by the Sea Charms and a selfie booth with Contessa de la Luna. We've got plenty of surprises and fun in store, so mark your calendars Thursday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets are available now online at ContessaWestern.BrownPaperTickets.com or at the door the night of the event. Get your hat, get your spurs, and come on down Thursday, February 9th at the Clinton Street Theater starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna's Wild West Jamboree, an old-time variety show.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Brought the bomb wrapped up in business cards and stained with steak. Who hires a maid to wash his money? Who keeps politicians on the take? Who puts outspoken third worlders in jail just to shut them down? Oh, the lies vary from place to place, but the truth is still the same, even in this town. Money junkies all over the world trample us on their way to the bank. they run in every race. Wendigo. Third worlders see it first. The dynamite, the dozers, the cancer, and the acid rains. The corporate caterpillars come into our backyards and turn the world to pocket change. Reservations are the nuclear front line. Uranium poisoning kills. We're starving in a handful of gluttons. We're drowning in their gravy spills. Their tongues are silver forks. There's a lack of wisdom. You can hear it on their breath. Wendigo. It's delicate confronting these priests of the golden bowl. They preach from the pulpit of the bottom line. Their minds rustle with million-dollar bills. You say silver burns a hole in your pocket. Gold burns a hole in your soul. Well, uranium burns a hole in forever. It just gets out of control. There was a crooked man who walked a crooked mile. He raised a crooked sixpence to hide a crooked style. He won a crooked vote, and he smiled a crooked smile. Wendigo. Their tongues are silver forks. There's a lack of wisdom. You can hear it on their breath. Wendigo, 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 Wendigo.
And good morning. Here we are once again. It's Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. I'll be with you for the next hour. And we've got my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, on the line. We'll be with her in a second. And it's not the second Wednesday of the month, but because things are happening hot and heavy at Standing Rock and everywhere else, it seems, we want to, and she's doing a talk tomorrow evening along with some other people. Goodness, I had that right with me. Let me see if I can find that. Well, here we go. Let me just announce that for those of you who can't stick with the program. Standing Rock Lessons Learned. That's tomorrow, Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m. At Patagonia, 907 Northwest Irving Street. A panel discussion on how to apply lessons learned at Standing Rock for continuing fossil fuel resistance efforts in the Pacific Northwest. Panelists will be, as I said, Jacqueline Keeler, author, indigenous rights activist, a radio talk show host, it says on there. Robin White, activist for indigenous labor and ecological rights. Mike Horner, co-creator of the Bunk Bus, environmental and peace activist. And Maya Jarad, organizer with 350 PDX. And the moderator will be Deborah Lev. And again, that's tomorrow evening, 7 to 9. And I suspect with everything going on, it will... I assume the debate will broaden out because, of course, what's happening in Trump Landia or Stephen Bannon Landia definitely is having and will have reverberations both at Standing Rock and throughout Indian country. So that's tomorrow evening. We need to take all these occasions of public gathering to discuss what's happening. Okay, so... you know, I've been seeing a lot of posts on Facebook. Yes, I'm on Facebook, along with so many other people, it seems, asking, you know, is everything going to be okay? That's such a terrible, touching question to have to confront. We always have to confront that, you know, and maybe just unconsciously, every day we're alive. But usually our sort of, to the extent that we are physically and mentally able-bodied, and of course, many of us are struggling with those with various issues all the time, but to the extent that we're able to have the life force rise up within us and express its natural, I call it natural optimism, because life wants to live. But, you know, we don't necessarily have to always pose that question, but with things happening and people being detained at airports, all these flurry of executive orders and pronouncements from on high, unprecedented in the history of the presidency in the first week. It seems like something like a shock doctrine, as I talked about last week. And I wanted to read a little bit from an article just to sort of set the tone from Heather Richardson, a professor of history at Boston College. I know this is making the rounds. If you haven't read it, I think this is important. She says, "I don't like to talk about politics on Facebook. Political history is my job after all, and you are my friends. But there's an important nonpartisan point to make today. What Bannon, Stephen Bannon, is doing most dramatically with last night's, I guess is written a few days ago, ban on immigration from seven predominantly Muslim countries is creating what is known as a shock event. Such an event is unexpected and confusing and throws a society into chaos. People scramble to react to the event, usually along some fault line that those responsible for the event can widen by claiming that they alone know how to restore order. When opponents speak out, the authors of the shock event call them enemies. As society reels and tempers run high, those responsible for the shock event perform a sleight of hand to achieve their real goal, a goal they know to be hugely unpopular, but from which everyone has been distracted as they fight over the initial event." And again, I'm just going to insert myself here. I mean, obviously, it's very real what's happening to those people who are under that Muslim ban order. And that's certainly not to, I don't believe she's, or I am trying to belittle the importance of reacting to that and confronting it. But we also have to look at the bigger picture of what's going on here. Last night's executive order has all the hallmarks of a shock event. It was not reviewed by any governmental agencies or lawyers before it was released, and counterterrorism experts insist they did not ask for it. People charged with enforcing it got no instructions about how to do so. Courts immediately have declared parts of it unconstitutional, but border police in some airports are refusing to stop enforcing it. And of course, the acting attorney general was fired for refusing to uphold it based upon its perceived unconstitutionality. Predictably, chaos has followed and tempers are hot. My point is this: unless you are the person setting it up, it is in no one's interest to play the shock event game. It is designed explicitly to divide people who might otherwise come together so they cannot stand against something its authors think they won't like. I don't know what Bannon is up to, although I have some guesses. Because I know Bannon's ideas well, I am positive that there is not a single person whom I consider a friend on either side of the aisle, and my friends range pretty widely, who will benefit from whatever it is. If the shock event strategy works, though, many of you will blame each other rather than Bannon for the fallout, and the country will have been tricked into accepting their real goal. But because shock events destabilize a society, they can also be used positively. We do not have to respond along old fault lines. We could just as easily reorganize into a different pattern that threatens the people who sparked the event. That's, of course, our challenge. A successful shock event depends on speed and chaos because it requires knee-jerk reactions so that people divide along established lines. This, for example, is how Confederate leaders railroaded the initial Southern states out of the Union. If people realize they're being played, though, they can reach across old lines and reorganize to challenge the leaders who are pulling the strings. This was Lincoln's strategy when he joined together Whigs, Democrats, Free Soilers, and Nebraska voters, and nativists, anti-Nebraska voters, and nativists into the new Republican Party to stand against the state power, the slave power. 5 years before, such a coalition would have been unimaginable, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one. There's many articles like this. I want to cite a couple other important articles. Steve Bannon's long love affair with war. Apparently, when he was a screenwriter in Hollywood, he loved war scenarios. He loves war games. This last paragraph here. Hammer was one of his favorite words, a former Bannon associate, another person requesting anonymity. All these people in these articles are requesting anonymity. Fancy that. For fear of reprisals, told the Daily Beast, "You're a hammer," he'd say if he really liked you, "if you're ruthless." Yes, that's what these people are. They're ruthless. They're white nationalists. They're playing a very dangerous game, and we have to react to that. And of course, one could also say this is also just the same old game of manifest destiny that has played out, unfortunately, on this continent for 500 years. And I just want to mention the opening song there, Buffy St. Marie, who I could listen to forever during these times, from her Coincidence and Likely Stories. That came out in, I only focused on this recently, in 1992. That was really her response to the 500th anniversary of the Columbus invasion. So with that, let me bring my guest, Jacqueline Keeler, up. Hello, Jackie.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Paul.
It was a very long introduction, I know, but I guess you're used to my introductions by now.
It's a serious topic. I mean, I think we all need to commiserate about what's going on right now. It requires a lot of action, but also a lot of thought too.
So, we do want to talk, obviously, about what's going on at Standing Rock, and that's what you're going to be talking about tomorrow evening. And we'd like to, give people a little sense for what's going to be discussed and why they should come and join in this important conversation. You want to start with Standing Rock or some of the more general discussions I opened up with?
Yeah, sure. I guess the big issue right now is, on the very second day of Trump's administration, he issued that memorandum basically saying that, to go forward with the, to push DAPL through, to get the Army Corps of Engineers to reverse its decision regarding the easement. And then recently, the last few days, Representative Kramer from North Dakota and Senator Hooven have been issuing statements declaring that it's a go, that the pipeline is going through. The tribe, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, has issued a couple of statements yesterday, the last one addressing it and basically saying that the Army Corps doesn't have the right to just carte blanche, stop the environmental impact statement from being study from being done. There's a process to it, normally speaking, and there has to be a formal sort of announcement to Congress. And then, of course, there's going to be lawsuits. The tribe is going to sue, because this is sort of a preemptory sort of it's just whatever the president wants, which upends the rule of law. And so they are going to sue in court. And so that's where it's really going to play out, are these lawsuits in court. And of course, there have been, the tribe has been asking folks to leave the camps. Anyone who's not a tribal member, or Lakota or Dakota. And there's been some question about what that means. I saw recently that some folks are asking people to come back. The veterans say they're going to return. So it's quite there's a lot going on.
But I hadn't heard that they're asking people to completely leave. I thought the goal was to actually move the camps so that they can
I'm talking leave the floodplain where the Ocheti Shipowin camp is at, and because they're in negotiations with the new governor. They have a new governor, Governor Dalrymple, did not run again or not win, and so they are negotiating to get the roadblock removed, which is really important to the community, the reservation, to the community of Cannonball and the reservation itself, because that's their main road to Bismarck, where many of the folks do their shopping. And also it's the main road that casino goers use to get to the casino, which is pretty financially important to the tribe. It helps them maintain many of their social service programs. And even with all the activists staying at the casino, at the hotel and eating at the restaurant, it doesn't provide the same level of income that gaming does.
Let's just make clear that the roadblock you're talking about is on the bridge over that main road between Bismarck and the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation.
Yes.
Where is the scene of many, many, many very heated confrontations and continue to be confrontations.
Yeah, there was, of course, in late November, there was the standoff there at the bridge where the sheriff's department used water cannons for 5 hours in sub-freezing temperatures on 400 protesters, water protectors, and endangering their lives, basically. And that roadblock is basically a de facto economic embargo of the reservation by the state of North Dakota. So getting that removed, and it's cost the tribe quite a bit of money. I mean, they're on Highway 1806. So the tribe it's necessary for the tribe to get that down at some point. And also, it also blocks emergency vehicles being able to come to the reservation. That was a serious issue during when people were being injured by the militarized police. They weren't able to get to medical care right away. Example would be, Sophia Walansky, the young woman who had her arm shattered and blown off by the concussion grenades being used by the police, and also Vanessa Dundon, the Navajo activist who lost her eye to having pepper spray sprayed right into her eye. These are things that are ongoing. The tribe is also wanting to clean up the area because of the floods that happen in the spring, and so they had signed a lease. They signed a permit, a camping permit, with the Army Corps of Engineers for the land originally, so that the camp could be there. And they'd also taken out some liability insurance, promising that anyone who was there would be safe. So they have a liability issue as far as people's lives. I think a lot of people aren't that familiar with floodplains, what it means, why it's dangerous to live in a floodplain. My family actually owns a farm in Washington State in the floodplain, and people are not allowed to live there because it's very dangerous in the spring, particularly. We actually lost 40 head of cattle because an ice dam broke and came inland for a mile along the Yakima River and crushed, basically killed the cattle. They were just, in a huge snowbank there, just their bodies. And, you know, it was very traumatic to go there the next day and realize it all happened overnight, like in an hour and a half. And our well was lined with inch and a half steel, and it was crushed like an aluminum can. I mean, it's for people, I can't imagine having people out there camped out and maybe unaware that it's approaching, trying to escape. It would just be, it's a pretty horrific situation if something like that were to happen. It is a serious consideration.
And for people who haven't maybe seen photographs, images of that Osheti Tsakoin camp and the camp across the river that are, as you said, in the floodplain, there's many, many, I assume there's still a lot of the same stuff is still up there. I don't think they've really dismantled much that I know of, but there's army tents, teepees, actual framed structures that many were being constructed when I was there.
Yeah.
In early December. So there's a lot to be done. I know there has been a request for skilled people and people with like flatbed trucks. But they're also, you know, you have to really check in. You have to get in touch first. I know there has been a request for specific people who have the skills to be able to dismantle and clean up that camp. That's one thing. And I don't know what the timeline for that is. I know there's still, I believe there's still snow on the ground, right? Obviously.
Yeah, there is. And actually, one of the local groups there is actually bringing in a crew of 25 people to clean up. They're not going to force the removal of anyone who's there. That's not something they're going to do. But they are, there is a cleanup crew coming in. Where was the name of the group? They're a group from Pine Ridge, Thunder Valley. The Thunder Valley CDC is partnering with the Standing Rock CDC in a cleanup effort that started, I think, yesterday. So they have trucks, tractors, and dumpsters. And
I hope they're able to salvage, because there's so much really good quality stuff that was donated, though. I really hope they're being careful about it.
I'm sure they are. I think so they're going to be moving all that. Sacred Stone, I don't think, is part of the order, I think, although I believe that LaDonna Allard is somewhat at odds with the tribe. But her area is in a bluff high above the floodplain and not really reachable from the main camp. But it also doesn't have a lot of camping area. That's why the overflow camp was established, because her camp, I think, was never larger than a couple hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not able to hold the 10,000 campers that were there at the Ocheti Shakoan camp. And certainly where the Ocheti Shakoan camp is in the floodplain would never have been a winter camp for the Lakota people in 150 years ago. I think that it would not have been chosen. It's a protest camp. It's a camp to make a statement. It's not a camp that you would actually camp normally. And so there are also, the state of North Dakota is become very active. They've been proposing a bunch of bills in their state legislature. One where they'd be able to take over the running of the reservations in North Dakota, which is a violation of the Trade and Intercourse Act, whereby the federal government reserves all rights to deal with tribes and foreign governments to itself. This is normally a federal power, because tribes are sovereign nations and states are not sovereign. They're self-governing. The sovereignty resides with the federal. And so this is like a blatant attempt to try to for the state of North Dakota to try to diminish the standing of tribes and to try to exert direct control over tribes like Standing Rock. And then also two more legislative bills are on the docket, which would criminalize First Amendment, First Amendment rights used by the water protectors, including defining loitering and other things and as hostile acts that can immediately it's the criminalization of the First Amendment rights. It's pretty crazy. And the state is very busy right now with that. So it doesn't look like it's definitely going to get worse.
I was going to read a little thing that I just saw, which is making the rounds here in a second. I also want to invite you to call in. You're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm the host. And on the phone with me is my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who is usually here in studio on the second Wednesday of the month. But as I mentioned, she and some others are going to be at a panel discussion tomorrow, Standing Rock Lessons Learned at Patagonia, 907 Northwest Irving Street from 7 to 9 p.m. And the other thing I want to get into is, you mentioned North Dakota trying to diminish the indigenous sovereignty there of Standing Rock and possibly other groups. There's rumblings of an analogous move at the federal level, which is, with people like Steve Bannon, the Svengali of Trump there, taking sort of seemingly apparently he's been writing these executive orders, and he's now in the National Security Council. He's been catapulted to a position of power and authority that is unprecedented for someone of his background. But so I want to just read this really briefly here. This is from Deborah McKay. This has been making the rounds on the internet. I'm not going to vouch for the accuracy of it, but it seems like this is an eyewitness report. So I'm just going to put it out there as it is. On January 18th and 19th, I observed, this is her speaking, Deborah McKay, water protectors with their hands in the air chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot," being fired upon at a range of 10 to 15 feet. Tear gas canisters and rubber bullets, which are regular bullets covered in rubber, were used against unarmed water protectors who had been singing and praying. I observed National Guard chasing water protectors off the backwater bridge, firing at people running away. I heard people choking and gagging from tear gas. I saw access to the water protectors' medic vehicles being blocked. I spoke with medics and water protectors who described bullets penetrating flesh and causing terrible injuries, including to one media person who nearly lost his finger when his camera was targeted. I talked with a media person and was told of four media people on the bridge that night. Three had their recording devices shot and the fourth his hand. I saw a photo of a sheriff aiming a rifle directly at a media woman who was standing apart from the crowd. And this is really a continuation of similar episodes that have been going on over a couple months.
They've been targeting journalists, actually shooting at them, and then also medics. Definitely, they're a target when they see the cross. It's the actions of it is really disappointing. That the Justice Department under Obama's administration did not take a stronger stance of investigating these. It was, listening to the final NPR exit interview with former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, I was very disappointed to hear, the African-American journalist not ask her about why these things were not investigated. There is no, I'd heard the Justice Department was investigating it and it was an ongoing investigation, so they couldn't comment on it. But we never got any final report. There's been no reporting on it, no national attention to these outrages, from the use of dogs. And there's been no, the Sheriff's Department never sent out arrest warrants for the dog handlers who were unlicensed. Instead they sent out an arrest warrant for Jamie Goodman, who was covering as a journalist, accusing her of inciting a riot. These were dropped and dismissed by the judge. The harassment of the media, the lack of oversight of violence by law enforcement and security, private security, and even construction workers working on DAPL. It's pretty astounding. I try to imagine if that happened at Ferguson, this journalist was interviewing Loretta Lynch, wouldn't that been a topic that came up? The fact that there was no response from the Justice Department, and the marginalization and the invisibility of Native people to most Americans allows this level of abuse. It permits it, and the marginalization of Native people and the invisibility of Native people is the direct result of U.S. policy to cloud the reality of Native sovereignty, because Native nation sovereignty is a direct threat to the legitimacy of the United States over much of its land base, and so it's always been an incumbent on the colonial government to basically delegitimize and disappear Native nations. And because of this, that means that there is really no consciousness in American people of all ethnic groups to understand what Native people, Native people are not just another ethnic group. We're not just another group of U.S. citizens. We are actually citizens of nations the U.S. actively, ignores in order to perpetuate its own, power base over our land. And so it's, I think that Americans need to rethink the paradigm of what their country is. They need to understand their country as a colony with colonial, why do colonies exist? They exist to extract the resources and the finance and as much money as possible, send it back to their ruling class in their home country from countries they are occupying. And this is what the U.S. is. It still is, even after the Revolutionary War. It's a home. It has no homeland. It's a colony without portfolio. And Trump is the absolute epitome of colonial aspirations. You know, I think there is really, even with a president like Obama sitting on top of a colonial structure, power structure of government, the colony still acts like a colony. This is what it's supposed to do.
I think, I think there's so many levels of discourse that this brings up that you're saying, but one thread before we get to Jack, who I know just called in, and if you want to just wait for just a second here, the analogy I've been making over the months between the United States and South Africa and Israel as a settler culture.
I don't like using settler because it implies that there is that they actually are settling something. I don't think they ever really settle. I think that it's a constant, you know, in the Lakota culture, we have this creature called the Iya, and the Iya is this monster that is constantly consuming and eating and eating, and it eats whole nations of people. You can see the campfires, the people inside its body.
Isn't that like the Wendigo that in that Buffy St. Marie song also?
I don't know. That's another totally different nation back east. But for Lakota people, we have the Iya. And it really is sort of, to me, that creature never settles. You know, settling to me has a sense of like having a relationship to the land that can be maintained over thousands of years. This is not the situation here. You know, that the colonists use the land is not sustainable over the long run. It's about immediate profits.
Well, then temporary settlers. Let me just say that.
Just call
anyway,
them colonists.
Colonists. The analogy between the United States colonists and the South African, and the difficulty of the bitter fight to end apartheid. But the difference being there is that in South Africa, the African population was so much outnumbered the white Afrikaner population, and the policy of the policy of genocide, and also you can't deny the influence of disease. Some people, I think, that might be overemphasized now in scholarship, but anyway, the combination of events, including a massive encouraging of quote settlement, the Homestead Act and all that, that basically the encouraging of the white, the European to European Americans to multiply and overwhelm the native population was successful, and so it was the greatest demographic surge in history, I understand, was the so-called the colonization, the so-called settling of the West, the colonization, the expansion of the United States throughout the North American continent. And that demographic, that unprecedented demographic expansion basically made it so that the type of resistance that eventually won in South Africa was much more difficult in the United States. But that just makes our task all that much more difficult, and how it's also easy to be to not really understand what's going on because it seems like something that it's not here. Anyway.
Well, definitely historically that was the case, but demographics are shifting now. But the issue is that I think that new Americans, new immigrant populations, or surging ethnic populations need to be educated. The problem is that the story that America teaches makes it impossible for people to act ethically and morally, because they are taught a story that relieves them of knowledge that could allow them to act ethically and morally. I think that people, that's why I really focus on reframing the discussion, because I really think that Americans need to get their head around the fact that this is still a colony, and it still has the mechanisms and structure, governmental and otherwise, and objectives of a colony. And that's the only way you can effectively fight something, is you know what it is, because it will lie to you, you know, and tell you something, it's something else. And this is the problem, is that Americans struggle with this concept of this is what we are. But in fact, you know, the very existence of states could not exist. States like North Dakota and Oregon could not exist without the destruction of Native nations. It is absolutely implicit, and the use of overwhelming military force to maintain that power. And that's what you see in North Dakota, is that here the pipeline is being built on unceded treaty land. The Great Sioux Nation, the Ojibwe Shekwan, never ceded that land. That land is still legally and otherwise, you know, the Supreme Court ruled in 1980 that the Fort Laramie Treaty and the right of the Great Sioux Nation to the Black Hills and all the other unceded treaty land is still valid. It was never legally taken. And so, you know, it is held by military force. You know, where Mount Rushmore is, where the pipeline is being laid near Bismarck, you know, half of downtown Bismarck, it's all held through military force. And I think that Americans need to be honest with themselves about that. And this is what you see visible, is when the tribe asserts its rights under the treaty to the land, you know, it's met with military force.
Well, let's,
that did not happen at Malheur, and it is not happening with other JAPL protests for other, on non-treaty land.
Well, let's give Jack a chance. He's been waiting on the phone. So, Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, that you pointed out the importance of the legal procedures in this. People should focus on that, I think. This is going to have to go to court to defend your rights legally, ultimately. And there's so much illegality here. There's a lot of material, a lot of evidence to support the lawsuits going forward. And I would say across the board, I've been saying this, you're going to have to sue, baby sue. Sue early and sue often. Sue this administration into perdition. Tie them up in the courts as much as you possibly can. And not just frivolously, there's a lot of substantive evidence of illegality. And the forces that have been amassed should be investigating. You've got if you can put 100,000 people in the street, give each one of them a computer and tell them to start researching, put things into databases, pass those on to the attorneys. As I've been saying, the attorneys are standing by to take your call. They really want to get at these guys, and that's, in my opinion, my humble opinion, the very best way to do it is get them into court. Already we're seeing it in Boston, in Washington State. The governor, the mayor of those locales have already told the Trump administration over the sanctuary city issue, we'll see you in court.
The problem is that there's an attempt to disempower the judiciary, this part of this general, what people are, more and more people seem to be calling an actual coup, you know, that is actually taking place before our eyes, that seems to be being masterminded and certain measure by Steve Bannon. So, you know, when the judiciary is going to be under attack, certainly the Trump administration is going to have they're going to have their own attorney general. They're going to have this new Supreme Court justice being so. The problem is that without a massive number of people actually engaging in more direct action, I don't see how ultimately it's not a given that the judiciary is going to be able to stand up fully to this administration if it is indeed something akin to a fascist move that a lot of people are talking about, that we may not be able to even talk openly about in the media. I mean, these are very serious things. Things are moving very fast, and we have to take that very seriously.
Well, yes, and a judge's position is a very serious one. Judges, like all other government officials, military officials, they are sworn to defend the Constitution, to protect the Constitution, and their services to the people. And it has to be continually pointed out that if a judge is handing down biased decisions, this has to be highlighted, spotlighted.
Okay.
Anyway, that's my opinion about how to move forward is to get them in court, make
okay.
sure the legal apparatus, use it to the fullest extent.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, and there are a number of, court cases going on right now. Of course, Earth Justice, which has been doing legal representation for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, has issued a statement saying that they will be pursuing legal remedies. I know that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe was actually looking at getting other counsel during the tribal council meeting in November. They were looking at securing another law firm, I think Sinofsky, and that was more familiar with with Indian federal law and treaty law. With Earth Justice's focus was mostly on environmental issues, and then of course my dad's tribe, the Standing Rock Sioux, the Yankton Sioux tribe, has also a pending lawsuit over DAPL with the Army Corps of Engineers presently in the federal courts, and it's considered. I've talked to a number of Indian federal legal experts, and they feel like the Yankton Sioux Tribe's lawsuit is much stronger than the one that was filed by Earth Justice on behalf of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe that did not do so well in the courts. So there are a number of legal challenges out there. I actually do take a great deal of it encourages me to see cities, like I think San Francisco just filed a lawsuit as a sanctuary city. I think that I do hope that the structures, the rural civil society is strong enough to withstand this. And certainly it's very heartening to see the responses on all levels. I think I was just reading an article in the Atlantic Monthly the other day, written by a conservative who is definitely, I think that it's, I don't know how dependable woke conservatives are, Republicans are as allies in this fight, because of course they would be drawn to power if they were offered it, even at the cost of, I think, of a Trump de facto imperial presidency. I saw another article in Medium that was pretty pretty concerning. It's called Trial Balloon for a Coup. It's written by Jonathan Zunger, and he was just an analysis of the actions of the Trump administration, and he sort of is reading the tea leaves and is seeing this as sort of these are all things like Trump has already filed his candidacy for 2020. He did that on Inauguration Day. And it says this opens him up to the ability to start accepting campaign contributions right away, which could be a way of actually procuring bribes, cash bribes during his presidency.
Fealty.
What?
Fealty, to use a feudal term.
Yeah, and of course you have a story about how he goes into a great deal of about how the Muslim ban was created, and its exclusion of green card holders, the inclusion of green card holders initially, but he believes that this was actually and how the career staff and many in federal departments are being left out of the loop in a lot of these decisions, and as you notice, like even being forced resignate the resignations some of these the State Department, the mass resignations were actually not mass resignations, but they were in fact forced resignations, a purge ordered by the White House. And
it's a concentration of power into a small inner cadre, basically. Yeah, I read that same piece. Interesting that guy's a professional at Google, an engineer at Google, and he's. But anyway, so let's go to another call. We're almost 10 minutes to go now, and the number is 503-231-8187. And Ed, I believe, if you're still waiting, go ahead. Is Ed still there? Nope, we lost him. Sorry about that, Ed. But if you want to call back, I know we've been gabbing away here, me and Jacqueline. These are important issues, but this is a talk show, and we would like to hear what you have to say also. It's 503-231-8187. I know we're also just struggling to come to terms with this, so I know that's what's going on with me. I'm just really focused on trying to get a handle on it, and I hope I'm helping other people in some small measure. I know that I'm struggling just to keep my own equanimity in the face of what's going on, and I think we shouldn't really hide the fact that this is all very disconcerting and that the stakes are very high. Sometimes it seems somewhat unreal even. I think we have to even fight that sense of unreality, that this is like some sort of reality TV. But of course, Trump, being a reality TV master himself, I think that the sort of tendency to think of him as a clown and all that, you know, while it's all very true, I'm sure, you know, his narcissistic personality disorder, but whatever. But these are the realities of power we're talking about. And these are people who are gathering and amassing power to themselves. And the only way to counteract that, unfortunately, and I know, you know, good people tend not to want to think about this, but the realities of power are that only some sort of counter power is able to contrast it. And we don't want to get into a civil war. I know people are even talking about that possible scenario, but we have to take very seriously what's happening. I think we have another caller on the line here. Anyway, go ahead, Jackie.
Definitely. I mean, I think California is talking about a Cal exit, you know, withholding taxes if they are penalized for having sanctuary cities, I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, actually, a California exit. The California is like the fifth largest economy in the world by itself. It's an incredibly powerful economic engine for the rest of the country. It only has two senators. Its will is not really reflected in Congress. Calls the question, what kind of representation we have as far as from the major the West Coast and the East Coast, the major engines of the economy. I was just reading this another article on Medium, which where a journalist at NPR, their show Marketplace, was fired from their job for writing a blog piece about called "Objectivity is Dead and I'm Okay with It," in which the reporter held that neutrality isn't real, and the changed role of the media and all of this has to be much more aggressive and not reporting as usual under the Trump administration.
And I'm sure that those people at NPR are definitely have very endangered positions. There's also talk of getting rid of or privatizing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But we have a DJ on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air. DJ, are you with us?
I'm in Iraq, and I actually just got back from there about a month ago.
Oh, sorry, we missed the first part of your sentence. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. I just got back from Iraq about a month ago, and I went with my girlfriend right now. She's a native person in the Yankton Sioux tribe. So there's definitely credibility to the police brutality going on there. It was very obvious even when we, walked over to an area that was actually the frozen Missouri River and just kind of prayed for about 90 seconds. Armed police came down, a whole group, maybe 15 in multiple vehicles. But I just wanted to make a point about, there was a guy who called and he's saying, "Sue, baby, Sue." And, you know, we got to approach this from a legal situation. You know, they have been pursuing different lawsuits, and they've been represented legally, the people who have been wrongfully arrested, and just the entire situation. You have to remember that for Native people, this whole law system that we have suing people, like, this isn't something that they ever asked for. And so when they see somebody coming onto their land, the little land that they have left, and they fight it, you know, in person by showing up and praying and, you know, even using their physical power sometimes, you have to understand that, you know, they have the right to do that. That's their land. And the perspective of just do, you know, it clearly hasn't worked with these executive orders. So, so, their strength in helping in a legal way, and their strength in helping by showing up and showing your support in person. You know?
Yeah, I think it's the legal system of the U.S. is set up to basically delegitimize Native nations' rights to their land. And, you know, the foundation is, of course, the Doctrine of Discovery, and which basically says that only discovering Christian European nations have title to the land. But the minute a discovering European Christian nation lands on, you know, on our shores, that immediately our title to our land reverts to them. And we only have the title that the animals enjoy, which is of occupancy and use. And this is still the law of the land in the United States, still part of the legal precedence that's been set. And it really needs, the U.S. needs to reject it. But the U.S. uses the Doctrine of Discovery to legitimize its taking of the land and delegitimize Native nations' title and right to their own lands, which is a basic human right.
That's at the large view. I think what DJ is pointing at is that it's an immediate situation. I know there's a tension between various elements, including sort of the official Standing Rock Tribal Council and chairman position and some of...
I think that, I come from a family of Indian lawyers, and I think... I think that there are many ways that Native people fight back, not just in stereotypical ways, but, we're a people, we're a modern people. We fight in many, many ways. My uncle, Sam Deloria, ran the American Indian Law Program at the University of New Mexico for 40 years, educating three generations of Native lawyers. So it's part of our tradition now. Fighting in the courts, even though the courts are stacked against us. The nonviolent standoff that's going on is very important as well. It's all of a piece. All of it is Native ways of fighting back. So I really don't like it when people stereotype Native people and then say they only do things in these sorts of ways, because if they knew more about Native people, they would know that's not true. And, I think that's one of the problems in American culture, is that we don't have enough knowledge of modern Native families, of what they're like, of what Native people are doing. All we have are stereotypes, particularly those promoted by mascots and by Hollywood. I think that the problem with the Earth Justice lawsuit is that it wasn't a very strong lawsuit. It was done under a very limited scope, and this is why it lost. I think that the Yankton Sioux tribes lawsuit is much stronger.
Well, we'll see. And we only have a couple minutes left, and I thank you, DJ, for calling in. Sorry to cut you off like that. I just want to read one other paragraph here. There, driving away from the area on Monday, I saw a convoy. This is, again, from Deborah McKay, her account. I saw a convoy of construction vehicles heading to the drill pad. Last night, an indigenous website live streamed reports of drilling and construction noises coming from the drill pad. Without the eyes of a free press, these attacks and trespasses continue, with the human rights and sovereignty of indigenous peoples denied. And it goes on. I will link to this. I will post this at KBO.FM Wednesday Talk Radio. But this is really serious. Apparently, you know, the Army gave the go-ahead for the easement, even though the environmental impact statement hasn't been completed. So once again, the Trump administration is basically, what they're doing is shock and awe with all these executive orders, but also they're basically just running roughshod over due process. That seems to be their strategy. And then they'll, what can happen is they might even be able to get this construction underway. And then, when will it even get into the courts? You know, that's been the strategy of corporations in logging issues and many to basically just make it a fait accompli. It seems to be the basic.
This is why the issue has to be that America is part of what's going on right now with this conflict between Trump and the rest of America is that what needs to come out of it for Native people, for our interests to be addressed in a comprehensive way, is we need for Americans to understand us as sovereign nations and to build that into the system. Right now, the present system that denigrates our sovereignty, and that's built into the system. That was even happening, under Obama. The issue is that we need to change the relationship. We need for Americans to get into their brains what the relationship really should be,
and that means
actual political status.
That means those of us listening and those of us who are getting active for the first time, who've been active, we are out of time, Jackie. Thank you for being part of this conversation, and thank you to all those who listened. Sorry we didn't get to the people who called in and wanted to join. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is February 18th at 5 p.m. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to the community and KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. Apply today to support your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
On Friday, February 3rd, 2017, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we'll agitate with the music of Frank